This summer, I'm going to avoid spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
You're listening to archival content from CKUT 90.3 FM's Time Capsule. Check out ckuttimecapsule.wordpress.com for more.
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hello, you are listening to Labor Radio, broadcast every third Thursday of the month on CKUT as part of the Off the Hour News Collective. This episode has been pre-recorded. I thought that this month we could take a voyage to Detroit and Halifax to discuss urban planning, displacement, and infrastructure and their role on racialized communities. We're going to start off the hour with a talk by Monica Lewis-Patrick, co-founder of We the People of Detroit, an organization that sets up emergency water stations and delivers water. We'll follow that with excerpts from the documentary Remembering Africville, a talk by Delise Mugabu, geography scholar, and an excerpt from the launch of Ted Rutland's book Displacing Blackness, Power, Planning, and Race in 20th Century Halifax. We'll continue exploring current issues in Halifax, specifically the gentrification of the North End, where many of the families from Africville were moved to after the destruction of the community, and hear an interview with Taylor McLean, a janitor in Halifax who describes the racism inherent in that industry. In that discussion on gentrification, we will be hearing from Leslie Carvery, a dancer and author now living in Montreal. Finally, we'll top off the show with a discussion of what can happen when communities take planning into their own hands, and we'll hear from Diana Nucera, co-founder of the Detroit Digital Justice Coalition, on communities with no internet access who are building their own Wi-Fi networks and preparing themselves to be able to communicate in the event of a political or ecological disaster. It's an action-packed show, so keep it locked. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM here in Montreal. This is Labor Radio.
Of the dismantlement of democracy. And so what we were able to witness is that we had to deputize ourselves, we had to take on the responsibility of the legacy of work that had been established in this city, but we also had to be bold enough to decide that we had to go into new directions. And so some of the work that happened with We the People of Detroit as we were deputizing ourselves is that during the bankruptcy, they were massively shutting off water in the city of Detroit. And if you don't know, you're sitting in a city that has cut off over 100,000 households from water. Potentially around 350,000 people have been denied access to water. Also, what you're sitting in is over 100,000 households have been illegally foreclosed on. So a lot of the devastation that you're witnessing across the city is by design. And of course, we knew these things in Detroit because the people most impacted are the experts in their own lived experience. But what we also knew is that somebody had to deputize themselves and actually codify all of this in every way possible. We had to use media making. We had to use graphics and digital design to be able to speak in one voice to multiple audiences. And so out of this work we created, and I believe this is part of this infrastructure that Jenny is talking about, is through cooperative work and through self-determination, some of the first work that started was just being able to deliver water to households that didn't have water. And then what we did is we began to caucus with some of our elders who talked about the fact that we had the expertise among us, but we needed to connect that expertise in a way that was disseminating a pipeline of information out to our community. And so our partnerships were a part of what was happening with Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. It was connected to Detroit People's Platform. It was connected to Allied Media. But we also needed an arm that will concentrate on what was happening to water in the city of Detroit. And so we created We the People of Detroit's Community Research Collective. And some of the first work we did was to put maps out that would actually set the record straight that this system that you see that the brother just talked about in Flint is deeply connected to the citizens of Detroit. And the way that that is that this system, if you look at the top of the T, you'll see that Flint is at the top of that T. Well, this water system was built by the citizens of Detroit, and we provide water to 126 municipalities and townships. 3.8 million Michiganders get their water from the citizens of Detroit, and that very same well, the citizens of Detroit are being denied to access it. Well, somebody would say, that ain't right.
No, it ain't right.
That ain't right. And what we did is we wanted to make sure that you understood what was happening in the city and that we were making it really plain for everybody to understand. And so when you look at the map, you see what happened. Flint was taken off of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department system because it would weaken and make Detroit insolvent and force it into the status of this illegal bankruptcy. The other thing we wanted to make sure you knew is the history of the system. This system that we were forced to build out to our suburban brothers and sisters, we were forced to do that and legislated by the state of Michigan to do so. But the debt stays with Detroit. So you have over 78 municipalities in that 126 municipality service region where the citizens of Detroit are paying 83% of the debt service as well as the processing fee for the waste of those cities. And they pay 17%. This system was meant to service 2 million people. Right now in the city of Detroit, you have less than 700,000 people, and 174,000 of those are children. When you look at the map, the other thing that people didn't know is that water is sold to our suburban brothers and sisters. It's sold to them wholesale. Detroiters pay retail. All of the suburbanites are actually upscaling their rates to the tune of 100% or as much as 1,000%. And because there's this very racial divide in Michigan, then the narrative is those black folks have failed in Detroit. We're paying for their bankruptcy, when in actuality it's their own municipalities gouging them. But the way that this becomes a tool and an instrument of change is that when we take this information out to the suburbs, they don't know this. And when we begin to talk about power versus parties, we find that we have more in common and we're able to unite our power. And this is what this is about. We also wanted to make it plain in terms of the structural change over the water department. Even though the debt stays with the citizens of Detroit, the governance structure leans toward the suburbs. So the very suburbanites who believe that failed leadership is the reason Detroit hasn't done well are the very people that are benefiting from that very system and its power dynamics. This here was critical because a lot of times people don't understand the racial components of what is played out here in Michigan. 53% of the African American population in this state is under some form of emergency management.
37 states across this country is under some form of this preemptive legislation. What emergency management allows them to do is to set aside democracy, set aside your voting power, carve up unions. So many of the privileges that we enjoy and that we take for granted are totally being dismantled right before our very eyes. This is critical. Because a lot of times when we talk about these issues, we talk about the issues, but we don't talk where there has been major interventions. When you look at the water struggle, you had major interventions happen. And I want to make sure you take this message with you back to your communities. Yes, there has always been water shutoffs in Detroit. Nobody is asking for free water. We are asking for affordable water. We actually have set the template for what is happening right now in Philadelphia and in Baltimore. What we know about Detroit is this. We understand that water affordability is not just about Detroiters getting water. It is about the human right to water. And so this is what the uplift here is about. It's about codifying in language that is very clear that every human being should have a right to water and the right to drink water that is clean, safe, and affordable and accessible. So what we've done here in beloved Detroit is that we have continued to connect that struggle to every struggle that's on the globe. What we know here in beloved Detroit is that every time the people have stood up and resisted this tyranny, they have had to step back and stand down. What I'd also say to you is that you must understand how the dots are connected on a global scale. When you look at just water and you talk about the DeVos family, that family is deeply connected to the privatization of water around the globe. What you must know is that that family is also deeply connected to the privatization of public education. They are also a part of privatizing transportation at many of your airports around the globe. They're also a part of the tyranny that's playing out in Palestine right now. So when we look at the extraction that's happening by Nestle, where Nestle can be allowed to extract millions of gallons out of the water system of the Great Lakes, over $200 is all they pay. And the average person in Flint is paying anywhere from $250 to $400 a month just to access water they can't drink. If you don't have running water in your household in the state of Michigan for more than 72 hours, you're in imminent danger of losing your children and your property. So what I will do in close with this piece of work for you, we have a legendary figure here by the name of Coleman Alexander Young. And he told us that if you find a good fight, get in it. Mm-hmm. Well, I would say to everyone in this room, you have a vested interest in making sure that we protect the Great Lakes, because 85% of the bottled water that comes across this country that's consumed comes out of those lakes.
People were not concerned by
us. Water is a human right.
They always had that,
right that
self-styled God complex.
And we will not be denied that right in the great city of Detroit.
That you could not make decisions. That we do all your decision-making for you. And that was what happened in Africville. They went through the exercise of having meetings with the people there, but behind it all, decisions had already been made. That was prime land. That was important land. That this kind of land was not for the black people.
The whole thing in the eggshell was us. We was all accumulated as one. Because we were black, that's the reason why the city wanted to get us out of there. That's the only one reason why.
I think what you have to do is do your utmost to see that these folks are provided with housing as close as possible to what they would find acceptable, and yet it must conform to minimum standards.
Living conditions. That was one of the things that they used against us. The city saying that our living conditions were substandard. And even today, in some of the articles that you might read, you'll see living conditions brought up quite often. Maybe they weren't up to standard to the people who set the standards. But to us, that was home, no matter what the houses looked like. There were other communities, and not just black communities, that had also the same type of living conditions, if not worse. But we were close to the city, and we were predominantly black. So our living conditions were used, it was used as a reason to move us. Even though our situation could have been easily upgraded with some plumbing, some paved roads, the city wouldn't give us this.
City government will have to do more for them to help them acquire a site if they have the competency to do so.
And the money, in other
words. The money, yeah. Provide the... you will have to give a greater measure of financial assistance and guidance in order to help them overcome the discrimination that does exist. This is a problem, and the only way that you can solve it is to do so with the understanding that well-trained social caseworkers can bring to bear on it. And there must be, in the leadership among the community, an understanding that what is being done, what is being done in the total public interest, including the best welfare of these people themselves and their children.
So when you woke up the next day and looked around, you found that Mrs. Brown's house over there was no longer there. And that really, that had a psychological effect upon people, too. So this was the method which they used. And when you find yourself, all the desolation all around you, it sort of softens you up to decide when you might as well move, too, as well.
We were under the impression then if they said move, you go. They said come, you come, and all that. And you see, those things then, you just went along with it. It would have never happened today.
They took our homes. They moved us out of Africville in the city garbage trucks. We had a lot better out there than some places they put us in this city. They put us right in, a lot of us, down in the slums. The meanest part that they did to Africville, they got the older people, the old people together. They didn't want to hear anything from the younger generation because they simply knew that the older people didn't have any education. What is $500 to a 75-year-old Negro? He thinks he's rich. What can he do? He can't even... We haven't even got enough to put down one payment for a home. Nothing. I'm living on welfare. I think a whole lot of us, when we came in this city, we had to go on welfare. When we lived in that city of Africville, you look in the records and see how many Africville people had to humble and come to the city for welfare. We were too independent. We didn't want it. We earned our own living, and we earned it the honest way. Our boys never had so much trouble until they came in the city.
We have attempted or offered alternative accommodation in our public housing projects. Many of them are scheduled for ultimate demolition. But as an initial move, they are basically better than the accommodation that's available in the Africville area.
All this is owned by Central Mortgage and Housing. You can't do anything to it, personally yourself. Like, you can't put anything in it, change the fixtures or anything, because it belongs to the city, right? Like, you can see there's no grass. There's only concrete, no open spaces. When we were out home, out in Africville, we had a lot of open spaces where we could play, and that was all taken away from us. It destroys people's sense of, being who they are, knowing who they are. You're just like another number, number on the block. That's all you are, you don't have no separate identity because everything's the same.
Cried when she had to leave. She was never happy after she left. I believe that the relocation took away 5 years minimum from the lives of our loved ones, of our elders, that we lost because of the move.
Do you enjoy talking about Africville?
No, I don't.
Why not?
Because it hurts me.
Why is that, Mr. Sheehan? Why does it hurt you to talk about Africa?
Because it's one of the nicest little communities I ever lived in. And to tell you something, I've been around this world twice. I've never met a place like Africville. Never.
But Mr. Steed, everybody thought it was such a bad place.
Who?
All the people who tore it down.
Oh, the people that tore it down. That's the people that tore down the city of Halifax, the authorities of the city of Halifax.
They said it was a bad place.
That's what they called it. But it was not to us, it was a heaven, a home, a real home.
Elcock, Alexander, Anderson, Berryman, Bowles, Brown, Byers, Carter, Carvery, Cassidy, Desmond, Dixon, Downey, Emerson, Farrell, Ferguson, Fletcher, Flint, Gannon, Grant, Hamilton, Howe, Izzard, Johnson, Jones, Kane, Keeler.
Now, let's consider the words of Annick Germain, a white professor in urban sociology and immigration at the Institut National de Recherche Scientifique here in Montreal. In an interview with La Presse last year, speaking out of turn and over black people, Germain praised Montreal in having succeeded where other large cities have failed. And I quote her, this is excellent news because this trend indicates much better integration by immigrants. Because it's a French-speaking society, Montreal has a greater cultural diversity compared to other Canadian cities. All these immigrants that choose Montreal really don't want to glue themselves to their compatriots. They left their country to move on to something else, to build a new life. They don't want to move into a neighborhood that will drag them back to their past. Now, I just noticed that I erased the first sentence. So the first sentence was about this report that she had brought out saying that Montreal was the first city where ethnic communities were now becoming more diverse and that new immigrants were spread out in Montreal. And this was cause to celebrate because it speaks to there not be ghettoization. So I will come back to certain themes that Nurbissi Philippe and Germain point us to and where Ted's book takes us, but I wanted to start with Toronto and Montreal. While Halifax is the center of displacing blackness, my sense is that we should not misread it as a local history, but see it as one that as one that's very much situated within the Black Atlantic. From its opening pages, it becomes clear that this is the story of how white power organized cities once slavery had been abolished and black women, men, and children had their own desires and demands upon the land they inhabited. A real tour de force of the book is in tracing how a number of white actors and their ideas about health, progress, morality, and governance traveled from England to Mexico to the United States, across Canada, and were applied in Halifax. In other words, a number of interventions and planning came from ideas that had been defined and applied in many other cities in the Western world. Tracing how and where these ideas were conceived helps us see how blackness anywhere has to be contained for white futurity to be expanded everywhere. This is indeed because slavery created a Western world where black people were all over the place. And the anti-black definition of modernity and progress in an era of urbanization cast blackness to the periphery and remakes black bodies again as movable. What displacing blackness keeps at the center is how projects of urban revitalization and renewal are built on the premise that new modes of living require Black uprooting and dispersal. So this is why Annie Germain's statement was so violent to me, because it was a celebration of Black dispersal. So first and foremost, this book is especially important for us here because of all the different ways that Black community life in Montreal continues to be assaulted and the geographic consequences that this assault has on our various projects of Black community building and organizing.
Planning in Halifax is and has always been a world-altering instrument of power and race. As an East Coast settler city founded in 1749, its very existence is owed to the planned creation of a white settler city from scratch and the planned dispossession and murder of the native Mi'kmaq. This exercise of violent sovereign power, entwined with planning from the beginning, achieved its most gruesome effects in the 18th century, but it has endured into the still colonial present as well. In the second half of the 19th century, urban planning acquired a new form as city leaders in the city began to introduce a set of techniques, forms of knowledge, and objectives that they described as modern. This newer, modern form of planning tended to be concerned less with securing physical territory than with producing and regulating material conditions in such a way that human life was protected and secured. Whereas Halifax's first planners sought to establish a territory that could be controlled and administered by the colonial state, an exemplary modern planning initiative would seek to protect the, quote, physical and moral health of city residents, make the city a, quote, more agreeable place to live in, or, quote, improve the general welfare of the population. The pursuit of such objectives from the late 19th century onward reworked and rearranged the ground of colonized territory. Significant planning initiatives in 20th century Halifax included the development of sewer and water systems, the establishment of building codes and property development regulations, the demolition of impoverished slums, and the redesign of the city's public spaces. And these and other interventions, the remaking of physical spaces through planning, was meant to act upon individuals and populations, to protect and improve people's lives according to period-specific conceptions of human flourishing. The arrival of these new planning ambitions was accompanied by new and complex forms of subjugation. As I explain in the book, modern planning's attention to human flourishing has gone hand in hand with various forms of physical displacement, political exclusion, sanctioned exposure to dangerous living conditions, imposed impediments to good health or welfare, and enforced restrictions on people's movements and daily activities. In some cases, effects like these are traceable to the exemption of certain lives from the sphere of planning's concerns. The terrain of planning of life that planning seeks to safeguard simply does not extend to these lives. In other cases, adverse effects like these are more intimately connected to the operation of modern planning. Here, it is precisely through targeted degradation and subjugation that planning seeks to promote a better form of life, either for the broader population or for the adversely affected residents themselves. In all cases, the lines between lives improved and lives degraded is written most clearly and indelibly in the font of race. From the late 19th century to the present, evolving conceptions of race have shaped the meaning of the life that planning has sought to secure and nurture, and have contributed to planning outcomes that are racialized in both self-evident and surreptitious ways. While Halifax planners' horrific overt war against the Mi'kmaq has ceased, the city's Black residents have experienced modern planning as an unyielding source of imperilment and plunder. These residents, who have numbered between 8,000 and 20,000 people in the 20th century, are largely descendants of formerly enslaved people who migrated to the region between 1783 and 1834 and were forced by the state to settle in a series of segregated communities outside white cities and towns like Halifax. And this is a map of seven or eight Black communities in the vicinity of Halifax. Modern urban planning, my book argues, is formed by particular entanglements with power and race. The power of modern planning is expressed less in the creation of sovereign territory than in the creation of material conditions that act upon individuals and populations, the creation through spatial means of tangible improvements in human health, happiness, and well-being. The paradox of modern planning is that these seemingly benevolent aims are structured by evolving normative conceptions of what it means to be a human being. Many social groups have thus found themselves expelled from the conception of human life that planning has sought to safeguard. Yet, life's pathological outside has been defined and populated most enduringly by the city's Black residents, and a deep-rooted structure of anti-blackness has shaped planning's dealings with all city residents, black and non-black. This structure, this expression of racial power, is the focus of my book. The book traces the imbrication of planning, power, and race across more than a century of history in Halifax. Seeking to eliminate both constants and variations in planning's operation, each chapter documents the emergence and consequences of a particular planning vision or project, a particular instantiation of planning's more general commitment to improving life. The book, while attending to diverse and not always racist forms of subjugation, advances the core argument that anti-blackness is fundamental to the operation of modern planning. The moves of modern planning, its attempts to create a life-improving urban terrain, are rendered conceivable and achievable by the displacement of blackness. This displacement is sometimes physical displacement, and sometimes symbolic, displacement from the field of planning's concerns. Displacing blackness, physically and symbolically, is an unending work of modern planning.
Now we witness the gentrification of the neighborhood as developers grab as much of the land as they can to build condos and high-rises while our children do not have the necessary services that they need to survive and to thrive. Along with AUBA clergy and community leaders, I have met with the mayor, law enforcement, and public safety for over 2 years, discussing what we can do to try to address the drugs and violence in our community. As we see our children dropping out of school and choosing dangerous lifestyles, parents, teachers, and community members struggle with ways to help our young feel valued. We want to show them that they are human beings, that they have worth, and that they have alternatives.
Yes.
They need legitimate jobs,
yes,
so they don't have to resort to illegal activity.
Yes.
A vote of 18-4 plainly shows that the majority of counselors,
yes,
simply do not care what happens in this community.
Yes. It is.
When profit comes before people.
So I hear these wonderful things, and I've read and I've seen pictures, and so I'm just amazed when I see the pictures of the old Gottingen Street, and I'm thinking, wow, what happened? But I know what happened. Urban renewal happened.
Terrible decisions
have been, especially the business community. I mean, they all packed up and moved out, and they boarded up. There was a bank. Was it a bank, Montreal? I'm just trying to remember. Sobeys was there at one time. There was a department store, a Metropolitan store. A lot of different businesses that were convenient for families, and as they were closing down, it really had an impact on this community, because then the community had to leave to go to do the personal shopping. And it has not changed from the 80s. There's some few businesses that have come in since, but not to the same extent. And I think most urban areas have experienced that, where there's a close down of businesses, convenience stores in the particular community. And then, residents have to go out of their community for services and shopping and so on. So, there is a big change. It's just not the same street.
Gottingen Street, what we call Lower Gottingen Street, toward downtown in the Citadel, was a thriving commercial area after World War II and into the 1950s. Many people say it was the urban renewals in the 1960s that kind of, some say, desecrated the periphery of Gottingen Street. And others say that the building of Scotia Square took commerce away from Gottingen Street. And so the so-called economic decline began probably in the 1970s.
It's not something that you think about at the time. Like, you don't think there's this grand conspiracy working against you, but it's something that you think about as you sit in your window and watch a complex across the street being built, and then you watch the people move in, and they're the same people that you're hoping might come to your business and support your neighborhood, and you see that they're not. They're blatantly not. I had a small cafe here for a minute because I was really creative in the sense that I would just kind of find ways to make money. So I opened the cafe here in this very space just for a short period of time. And I would see guys go across the street with Tim Hortons or out of the neighborhood coffee. And they knew that I was open and they knew that I was struggling. I had to make very little on tea and coffee to survive. And I couldn't, you know, again. So, yeah, it was there. But I didn't wake up every morning and blame that for my problems.
My name is Taylor McLean. I'm one of the workers that was laid off during the whole conflict between us and Armor Group.
My name is Darius Munshari. I'm a union organizer with SEIU Local 2 and the Justice for Janitors movement, and was one of the main organizers getting people together to call attention to this injustice that occurred at Founders Square here in Halifax.
I guess it's hard to explain if you haven't experienced it. In a sense of that, like, when you're working, you have to realize that certain things will be kind of swept under the rug for other people. So, like, say if I'm late, maybe like 5 minutes to work, it's a big deal in certain places. But yet my friend who's white could be late. And we actually used to joke about this all the time. We used to laugh about this all the time. He was like, oh, man, I've been late like every single day, like 20 minutes since I got hired last year. And they have barely said anything to me. And he's like, you're late like, you know, 5 minutes, 7 minutes. And they always call you in the office and talk down to you and stuff. And I'm just like, yeah, man, it's just funny. There was an incident where he got called into the office to serve me notice that I was getting written up for being late the day before. But he was late that day that he showed up to get that notice. And they were telling him, like, oh, man, you got to tell him that he's getting written up. And he was like, man, I feel super uncomfortable because, like, I'm late right now, today, the same amount of time. I've been late every single day. Like, what's going on? He's just like, oh, it's different because, you know, you're a supervisor or you're this or that. After a certain point in time, so many things, little things kind of get to you where it's just like, if you do something, it's a big deal. But if another person does something, you know, it's, oh, we'll just sweep it on the rug. It's not a big deal, you know? There's so many little instances like that where it's after a certain time, you kind of just expect it and you just kind of laugh about it because it's just so blatant. And the defense for it is so out there that it's just like, what are you going to do? I mean, like, you just got to keep working. You're not going to quit your job. You just kind of have to just realize that there's different standards in play for you if you're of a different race. It just happens all the time, you know? So, like, what I have to explain it to people is, like, I have to reach back into my brain and think of, like, a specific time because it happens so many times in so many different ways. But that's one of the ways. It could be, you know, you get passed over for positions that are higher up in the food chain for someone that has less seniority than you. My parents, when they were raising me, are talking about jobs because they've had to deal with it on a more extreme level because of the time that they grew up in. My stepfather was born in 1949, and my mom was born in 1961, right? So it was kind of this push to be like, whatever you do and whatever you are, if you're working as a black person, you have to be perfect pretty much. Like, you can't slip up, you can't slack because, you know, the white kids over there can slack and it's just like, oh, you know, they just had an off day. But if you slack and you're a minority, it's all those minorities are, you know, they're late and stuff like that. And I've seen people talk about some of the immigrant workers that we have, you know, because, you know, those guys don't want to do anything. They just, you know, they're so greedy. They want their money and this, that, and that. And it's just like, you know, just blatantly talking to you about it and you gotta turn around and then someone brings up racism or act like it doesn't exist. And it's just like, man, I've been watching you guys talk about people. I've been watching you guys treat people differently this whole time. And you're telling me that it doesn't exist. And especially when you're doing servant work, you're doing, you know, service work for people. You have that added classism on top of that. And when historically, you know, your people have done the work that was looked down on and they were kind of judged by that, it's just kind of natural for people to kind of judge you like that. Like, this is what you're supposed to be doing. Like, this is what you are. You know, this is what you've always been. This is what you're always going to do. They look at you less than as a person or just as someone that throws their garbage out.
So at Founders Square, whether it was overt racism, where they made a very conscious decision that they didn't want to have any of the black workers continue to work there, or if it was not overt and just structural, there's still a racial injustice at play. If the property manager and the new incoming cleaning company said, hey, we got to make sure that this one worker here has continued employment, we like him, whatever, and they didn't provide that same decency to the other workers, not out of malice, but they just didn't do it because they didn't think it was necessary, there's still a racial injustice at play. Racism doesn't have to be overt bigotry all the time. way that cleaners are given access to different shifts. When you look at a lot of the cleaning companies, they'll have white workers in the day and they'll have workers of color at night. And they'll come up with different excuses for that. But there are structural issues related to racial justice in this industry, in this community. Now, it's happening all the time, and no one will hear about it or see about it because a lot of the times there's no union there to advocate for workers or to help workers fight back. I'm sure this is happening in a lot of non-union companies that we don't even hear about it. We heard about it in this particular situation because we found out some of our members were being laid off and we went and talked to them. And then we found out that, oh, not only are they not offering continued employment to most of these workers, there's a racial divide in terms of who is being offered this work, right? And we were able to then help people make the decision on addressing that. So when you have a union, you're able to fight for racial justice as part of that platform and having that power, right? And it has always been really important in terms of fighting for equality, fighting for racial justice. Unions have played a role in that. But within unionized environments, there's still all kinds of racial discrimination that happens, and we're seeing it here in Halifax with municipal workers. They just had a protest earlier this week making the same claims that, you know, they're passed over for promotions. They're not treated with the same level of respect. Equality, we haven't reached it. There's still a long way to go, and workers in this city are very much calling attention to that. And the systematic disenfranchisement economically of the Black community, the African Nova Scotian community, is an ongoing justice issue that's been happening for a very, very long time here.
Things in the neighborhood were moving into different directions, and I couldn't always keep up with it. We got the mega yoga loft up the street, which had like 10 instructors working there, all paying a rent, and I couldn't get anyone to help rent my studio out. And it was hard. I don't think I was climbing the ladder as much as I was just going lateral for a long period of time. I wasn't making my rent, but I was making my food budget. So yeah, it was very tight. And I know if I was watching someone speak like this on a documentary, I'd say, well, go get a job. But I didn't get a job. I continuously just tried to put my energy into this business and into what I knew how to do the best.
The most powerful and, I think, instructive engagement with planning in Halifax occurred in the early life of an organization called the Black United Front, the subject of my book's sixth chapter. The Front was created in 1968 amid the worldwide flourishing of Black resistance and a pair of high-profile visits to Halifax by well-known Black activists, including Stokely Carmichael, Mary Makaba, Rosie Douglas, and two members of the Black Panther Party. During the second visit to Halifax by such activists, a 400-person Black family meeting was convened in the North End Library, and a new organization, dubbed the Black United Front, was formed. This organization brought together some of the most important Black activists of the period, including Rocky Jones and Carrie Best, and would develop a political program that was distinct from previous formations in two major ways. First, its membership and leadership would be entirely Black. Second, its major goal would be the achievement of Black self-determination. Self-determination was an important concept for many movements in this period. It meant essentially assuring that Black people could, quote, determine their own destiny, either through the transformation of existing institutions or the creation of new ones. The Front, though it endured until 1996, was most effective in the period between 1969 and 1974. Its major political concerns in this period were usually categorized as housing, education, and employment, but it also engaged with urban planning in at least two major ways. First, the Front challenged racist hiring and promotion decisions at City Hall. It documented criticized the lack of municipal services and infrastructure in Black communities. It challenged racist federal and municipal housing policies. It directly combated racist landlords and employers, and called for the removal of white planning consultants from Black communities. Second, the Front created a series of alternative social programs. In the early years, the Front supported the creation of community-specific recreation committees that would oversee the creation of new infrastructure. It trained Black people to do housing surveys in their own communities. It oversaw the creation of community-managed housing and created new programs through which Black people could advance their political consciousness, analysis, and organizing abilities. In all of this work, the Front articulated and attended to a vision or genre of the human being that's very foreign to modern planning. The organization's varying commitment to Black life entailed another view of that life, a view in which Black particularities, when they existed, were not considered pathologies, and where a better form of life was possible and indefinable by Black people. Some of his actions aim simply to extend the benefits of planning to Black communities. Other actions, in contrast, devise new forms of planning based on the particularities of Black social life. Its housing program, for example, linked federal subsidies to community supply of construction labor, something that Black communities had long relied on. The end result was thus a more efficient use of available subsidies, as well as an affirmation of Black mutual aid, something essential to the Black conception of what it meant to be a human being. These experiments in planning otherwise were ultimately short-lived due to forms of state repression that I detail in the book. The example that it provides remains important nevertheless. For 5 years, the Front worked the outsides of planning's race-limited conceptions and imperatives, insisting that Black life was something other than a pathological version of white normality that, at best, could be rendered a little bit more normal, a little bit more white. This work, though eventually repressed and extinguished by the state, has endured nevertheless in smaller, less visible acts of Black resistance in Halifax area communities and in collectively preserved memories of what planning can look like when Black people claim the ability to determine their own destinies.
What a hard act to follow. Thank you, Monica. My name is Dinah Nucera. I am the director of the Detroit Community Technology Project, which lives here in Detroit. But before I get started in talking, we're going to talk about the internet, because just like water, I do believe we deserve that as a utility that is also free and open to the people. Because it was here in the AMC in 2009 in which we discovered that communication is a fundamental human right, and that the internet is a huge part of that within the way in which we communicate today. So I want you to think about every moment that you use the internet just in the past hour. Can you count it on your hands? Probably not. And so think about all the ways in which, if you did not have the internet, how your life would change, and how you as a human being would or would not be able to communicate with your loved ones or even be able to do the work that you do. Well, for many Detroiters, this is not a fictional question, this is a reality. The state of internet in Detroit is quite dire. I think we've done a lot of work, though, to improve it. And so I would say that maybe some of these stats are a little off, because I know that the digital stewards out there in Detroit have changed these. But that's right. 60% of households in Detroit don't have a broadband connection. If you're not familiar with what broadband is, it's 25 megabits per second or above. It takes about 10 or 11 to do streaming or to do any sort of video conferencing. The average around here is between, I'd say, 3 and 7. 40% of the households of Detroit have no internet connection at all, and this is fixed or mobile. I think people forget that not everyone has a cell phone or a smartphone. And 30% of the residents are living below the federal poverty level, and I believe that is deeply connected to why we don't have a good internet infrastructure. And up to 70% of school-aged children in Detroit have no internet access at home. This is a state of emergency. So what I want to talk about is a little different than thinking about a digital divide or wanting to bridge that, because what that suggests is that it's a simple solution that if you just create one thing to the other, you could solve it. But it's so much more complicated than that, because digital infrastructure is connected to every single part of our lives, our education systems, our governance systems, our water systems, everything. We are all connected in this digital world. We're at the epoch of a digital age. And so I want to talk about what it means to build a healthy digital ecosystem. So not just about getting a connection, but living with technology in a way that is holistic and actually transformative. So back in 2009, I think it was actually back in 2006, the world was asking, is Detroit even worth saving? Which is a completely different conversation of what's happening now. The question back then that the Digital Justice Coalition asked was, what will the role of media and technology be in restoring community and creating new economies based in mutual aid? And this is a fundamental question that has designed a lot of the work that we do. Because it's not enough to just build new infrastructure. This infrastructure has to be rooted in local relationships of accountability, as well as have authentic communication and also authentic relationships, or else it's just another sort of parachute in, we're going to build infrastructure, and if it crumbles, it crumbles. And as you can see, those of you who have come to Detroit, since the AMC's been here, the city's completely changed. And so in 2009, it was here at the Allied Media Conference, and the infrastructure of this organization has allowed for these conversations to take place, and we formed the Detroit Digital Justice Coalition. And it wasn't your typical form of technologists. It was elders and youth media educators, hip-hop artists, independent technologists, all coming together with this idea that communication is a fundamental human right. We created a set of principles, and this was key to doing this work. Because what does digital justice mean? It's going to mean something different to each of us, because the way in which we use technology is based on our individual needs. So these principles were created under four categories, and the ones that have created the most impact in the work that I'm sharing today are the two that I'm about to share. That digital justice demystifies technology to the point where we can not only use it, but create our own technologies and participate in the decisions that will shape communication infrastructure. At the time in 2009, this was a pretty radical thought. I think today this idea is actually a little more accepted and known that we have to do this. The other one is that digital justice provides spaces through which people can investigate community problems, generate solutions, create media, and organize together. So in the spirit of media-based organizing, building community wireless networks, or doing any sort of collaborative media, it is in that moment that creates those authentic relationships, that the knowledge is gained, and mutual aid is able to emerge. And so out of all that, we built the Digital Stewards curriculum. And that curriculum has gone quite far. And there are many people in this room that I know where I've been a part of creating it and have taken it themselves. So if you're out there, let me hear you, because I know some of you are in here. That's right. It's not just a curriculum, it's not just an idea. This is a movement of community technology. And this idea that we don't need telecom industries or major like computer scientists to come in and tell us how we build our own technology, that we actually have the brains and the capacity to learn it ourselves and teach each other how to do it and build it in a way that actually makes sense to what we need. And so these Digital Stewards program goes through many, many types of organizing. People learn how to install wireless connectivity, wireless routers. They're climbing up on rooftops doing construction. So our technicians are often, the internet service providers in Detroit often try to poach them because they're not just into one type of tech. They are well-rounded community organizers that are able to teach and learn with their communities. And I think this is what makes this particular work really powerful, is that we teach them, they teach others, those others teach others, each one teach one, and that's how we're going to change everything. And so the Equitable Internet Initiative is the work of digital stewards at scale. So this work is not new. We've been building wireless networks in Detroit for the past 7 years. And not the networks that first started don't get nearly as much love as the Equitable Internet Initiative has, but what's interesting with the Internet Initiative, what makes it a little more unique, is that we took the opportunity of having a local ISP that was building gigabit infrastructure in Detroit and negotiated with them to purchase wholesale internet. And the fact that we even had the audacity to think that that was possible, I think, is quite radical in itself. And so, yes, it is possible. You can start your own ISP. And you could be a brown girl and do it, too. Just to bring a few of our digital stewards into the room, this is a class that we recently graduated. What we're doing within the Equitable Internet Initiative is that we purchased gigabit connections. We trained digital stewards. There's about 45 of them that have been trained, 30 of them right now, 15 that are building out these wireless internet infrastructure within three neighborhoods and seeding neighborhood-based internet service providing. They're building businesses around it and everything. We trained youth in doing gigabit app development because I realized that if the gigabit culture within Detroit is started within community and from the roots of community, then that has a way of sort of changing the future of technology culture. But the whole thing is all based in education. I think people think like, oh, what wireless technology are you using? Like, what's your speed of gigabit, all this stuff. But really, this is all based in education and in the pedagogy, which we call community technology. The pedagogy is based in popular education and is replicating the citizenship schools of the civil rights movement. So the idea is that you're not teaching people technology specifically, but you're teaching them how to learn, and how to learn in multiple ways. And it is that will allow people to adapt along with technology, because as we know, this completely changes within a few minutes. I'm sure something new just came out, and we're gonna all have to upgrade tomorrow. So now that we've built these wireless networks, each neighborhood has an advisory board, they have applications within those networks, and we're building a resiliency network attached to it where there's preparedness plans, solar generators, portable network kits that will come out, and people are going to organize and use these networks in the case of a natural disaster as well as a political disaster, because we see those two things as the same thing. And it was during the Trump administration coming into office that we realized that these networks mean so much more than just getting a connection. People needed to have autonomous systems in order to communicate. And you don't know if those systems are actually autonomous unless you build it yourself. So there's many steps to this, lots of negotiating, lots of people just asking them to trust and walk off the cliff with me, with each other. And I just wanted to say that in order for this alternative infrastructure to come to scale, it required quite a bit of love. Not just love, but trust, and also patience. This took 7 years to get off the ground, and this particular Equitable Internet Initiative took 2 years to actually get the funding and the connections to do. So I'll leave you with a few questions that I have in thinking about scale. If love is at the base of all of this work, is love scalable? And my last question, sorry, I said I was going to leave two questions. But the last question I have is, as this scales, what needs to be put in place in order for the integrity and the values of the work to scale along with it?
Hope you enjoyed that show. I would like to end by acknowledging the hard work of the people who put together the Allied Media Conference in Detroit this past weekend, and also to thank the creators of some of the content you just heard. Remembering Africville is a documentary created by the NFB that you can catch for free on the NFB website. It's a really great film of about 35 minutes and should be required viewing for everybody in so-called Canada. Pushed Out, a documentary by Fatah Ahmed on the gentrification of the North End in Halifax, is also available on Vimeo. And Talking Radical Radio is a podcast and website you can check out if you want to hear the entire interview with Taylor McLean and Darius Mirsahi. The interview is entitled Demanding Justice for Black Cleaning Workers in Halifax. Monica Lewis-Patrick is director of We the People of Detroit at wethepeopleofdetroit.com. And Diana Nucera, in addition to her many other amazing tech community engagements, co-leads the Equitable Internet Initiative, an effort to redistribute gigabyte internet connectivity from downtown Detroit to marginalized neighborhoods. Leslie Carvery is the author of 3 books, including Africville, My Home, and finally, Displacing Blackness, Power, Planning, and Race in 20th Century Halifax, is published by University of Toronto Press and authored by local scholar Ted Rutland. Thanks for listening to Labor Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM, and hope to catch you next month.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, July 21st, 2022. On tonight's show, we take a visit to OFF-JFL and ZooFest. My guest tonight, comedian Mike Carrazza, on making space for experimentation with his show at OFF-JFL, ZooFest.
I'm happy that comics that I book on the show are eager to take those risks and eager to be like, I thought of something so silly and I'm not going to tell you. I can't wait to surprise you with it. And they do it, and either it hits or it falls flat. And either way, we end up having a good time with that.
Walter Jaylene co-hosts a show called Rad Dads Forever on his fatherly comedy pivot.
It's made my comedy accessible and relatable in a way that, like, to more people, to way more people than it was previously, you know, when I was up there, you know, making like more pop cultural references or doing this kind of stuff or doing other kind of stuff. But now that, you know, there's a lot of it. And, you know, even if you're not a